The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Chinese Whispers with me, Cindy Yu. Every episode, I'll be talking to journalists, experts and longtime China watchers about the latest in Chinese politics, society and more. There'll be a smattering of history to catch you up on the background knowledge and some context as well. How do the Chinese see these issues? Too often, our stories about China are dominated by the urban experience, probably because journalists inside and outside of China are often based in the big cities or Beijing specifically. City dwellers also tend to be more educated, more privileged, such as myself. I was born in Nanjing, a city of 9 million people. That's why I'm particularly keen to hear about the lives of those who still live in the countryside, or at least are still considered rural residents by the Chinese government. They make up a sizable proportion of the population today, and you'll hear that in my first question to my guest, we discuss just how big this group is. How do these people who are the poorest in China live today, considering the government has announced that there is no more extreme poverty there? How wide are their gaps in living standards, education, health, compared to their compatriots who live in the cities? Professor Scott Rozell joins me on this episode. He is the co-director of the Stanford Center on China's Economy and Institutions, a developmental economist who has been conducting research in China for over three decades. A few years ago, he wrote a book with Natalie Hell called Invisible China, How the Urban-Rural Divide Threatens China's Rise. Scott, thank you so much for joining Chinese Whispers.
It's nice to be here, Cindy.
Now, Scott, it's hard to know where to start with a massive topic like rural life in China. But I thought one place we could start with was just identifying the size of the group that we're talking about here. Because I've seen a few different numbers floating around. The Chinese National Bureau of Statistics says that just under two-thirds of China's population are permanent residents in the cities, which suggests 400 million or so who live in the countryside. But you've in the past said actually the real number is around 900 million rural people. So can you explain just how big this group is?
Well, I mean, there's two definitions of rural. One is the census-based definition. So this is on June 20th of 2020 or, you know, June 20th of 2010, it's where people were at. And that's where about two-thirds of the people in China are in cities on census day. Actually, their families are back in the rural areas, but they're counted as in the cities because mom and dad are there. But the other definition is by hukou, right? By the residency permit. And I often say the hukou is a little like the Indian caste system, except more rigid. And so, you know, people are born with a rural hukou or an urban hukou. So it's about 65% of people in China have a rural hukou. They're rural residents, and they're covered under different social policies. They're covered under different rules, and that's what 900 million are from. So there's about 900 million people with a rural hukou.
But the National Bureau of Statistics figure is just who was in the city and who was in the countryside at the time that the census was conducted. Is that right?
Yeah. And so about half, or maybe probably a little less than half of rural people were in cities at the time of the census. They're working there. They're living in dorms. They're living as nannies with families. They're in apartments and they're part of the gig economy, right? Out delivering DoorDash deliveries. So they're, the jobs are in the cities, but their residency is rural, which means that's where their kids have to go to school. That's where they get health care. Because they're rural, they can never be unemployed, right? Because if they lose their job in the city, if the construction site shuts down, if the factory runs out of work and lets them go, they can go back and farm. Because, you know, there's 200 million rural families, and every single one of them has a farm. Now, the average size farm in China is about 1 acre. That's like a soccer field, you know, so there's all these very, very different rules that apply to urban versus rural.
Yes, absolutely. And hukou is something that on this podcast we've discussed before. So I'll link in the description as well for people who want to hear a bit more about that kind of internal passport system. And I want to come to the question of employment in a bit as well, Scott. But before I do, you know, in one challenge of talking about such a large group of people, hundreds of millions of people, it's just how you generalize and how you say meaningful things that are illuminating, but also apply across that whole group. So, for example, there'll be huge regional disparities, presumably, in the rural experience within China.
Yeah, of course there is. And one is geographic, right? In general, rural people living along the coast in the coastal provinces of Jiangsu, Shanghai, Zhejiang, Fujian, Guangdong, they're higher population densities, they're closer to the cities, there's more industrial capacity in their counties, in their prefectures. The provinces have more money, they invest more in social services, as opposed to central and western China. And then Han versus non-Han ethnic minorities. There's, you know, huge differences. But in general, there's a lot of similarities, right? Overall, in China, you look at that census that says 65% of Chinese people are in cities. If you look at education there, what you find is of the labor force in China, which is about 800 or 900 million, that only 30% of them have ever been to one day of high school. And there's lots of differences within the urban areas. So 90% or higher of urban people have been to high school, which means that 20% or less of rural people. Now, this is people in the labor force, so 18 to 65. You know, and so we have lots and lots of areas where the people who we survey out in Western China, one out of six have been to high school, and five out of six have not been. And if you're in the coastal area, it's much better. It's probably half of them have been to high school. And younger ones, almost all of them have been to high school. So there's differences over time and differences across space.
Yes, and that sounds like a massive rural-urban disparity that you've already just hinted at and which you've written for years on. Just stick on education for now. Why does that disparity happen? As you say, is it getting better with younger generations, with more infrastructure, educational infrastructure around these countryside locations? Or is it just something else entirely?
So it's originally the hukou problem. I mean, there's two castes, right? I mean, so cities have lots of finance and they have... I actually don't know about the UK, but the United States were a very decentralized education system. We have 40,000 school districts that are all funded by local taxes. China has 40,000 school districts that are all funded by local taxes. And taxes in China are value-added taxes and taxes on services. There's no taxes on rural or agricultural activities. And so if you're a mostly rural county with not much manufacturing, you don't have any income. So you don't have any ways to have really good schools. There are transfers from above, but they're still minimal. And so it's just basically built into the system that it's there. To be really clear, though, in recent years, it's, you know, people often say, Scott, are you the only one that knows about this huge educational disparity? And the answer is no. I mean, the Chinese government has realized that they very, very much are in need of educating the entire workforce, including rural people, better. And they have increased slots in high school. They've started to pay teachers from the central budget. And so there's definitely improvements, but there's still a long ways to go.
There's also a nutritional question when it comes to education and attainment as well, isn't there? And I know that's something that you've looked into in the past about just in terms of the malnutrition of certain young people from certain rural parts. Can you talk a little bit about that, the disparities there?
Yeah, well, this is some good news. So, and this shows you that the Chinese government really does care about this. And when they see a problem and they think it's a problem, then they'll fix it. So it was, you know, more than 10 years ago, we started working with our colleagues on identifying nutrition problems. Mostly it was anemia, iron deficiency anemia, which, you know, has quite direct negative consequences on learning, right? I mean, if you're anemic, your brain doesn't, you know, function as well, and you can't learn as fast. And we do these big, large randomized trials, and you'd show that, you know, if in these 50 schools you give kids a vitamin, and these 50 schools you don't, or in these 35 schools, you give kids a nutritious lunch, in these 35 schools, you don't. You come back a year later and learning, the only difference in those schools is nutrition they got, the learning goes up, you know, anemia goes down. The Ministry of Education really doesn't care about the health of their kids. They care about math scores. And when they saw this, this was 10 years ago. And when they saw those goes up, that, you know, the national government launched National Nutritious Lunch Program. And, you know, so 40% of the kids, you know, were anemic in rural China. It took a while to get this program up and going. But, you know, we went back to the same schools that, you know, had 40% of the kids who were anemic in 2011, 2012, 2013. We went back last year, and the anemia rate is 5%.
Oh, wow.
So this National Nutrition Program, who's there's 39 million kids that get a nutritious lunch every day. It's billions, $5 billion a year budget. The anemia rate in rural China now is lower than the United States. So they've made tremendous progress in that, which, you know, it shows you. Then they say there's not enough high schools, so they start high schools. And there's lots of myopia problems, so they have glasses programs. So, you know, the Chinese government, we think that China is now confronting the last of their major human capital problem. And it's actually a problem that starts before school. So it's not even the Ministry of Education as well. It's, you know, the early childhood development is, we think, the last major problem in rural China to get human capital up.
Mm-hmm. And the Chinese government has been talking about poverty alleviation in the countryside as well. The late former Premier Li Keqiang spoke a few years ago about how many people were still living under 1,000 yuan a month, which is just over $100. And a year later, after that, Xi Jinping said that the country had eradicated extreme poverty. How much credence do you give to those claims that poverty as an economic metric has been eradicated?
Well, I would say there's no poverty in China anymore. You have to say that. What I say then, that 900 million people are low income. And so we now have a low income problem. Yeah, whether it's below or above a poverty line. You know, the fact is that rural people have, as you see, right, their nutrition is better. They're going to better schools now. So Li Keqiang said 600 million were 1,000 yuan per capita or less. The same people who created that data for Li Keqiang put out another study that said 900 million were 2,000 yuan or less. That's very, very low income. What I keep saying is these are the people who are supposed to, you know, if they're supposed to try to drive the economy by consumption, right? If you have 2,000 yuan per capita or less, you are not going to be consuming services. You're going to buy your basics and that's it. And, you know, I think this is a big part of China's problem, right? And we have a huge inequality problem in China still. There may be no poverty.
Well, Scott, that kind of anticipates my next question, which is just away from the statistics, what do these income lines actually mean on the ground in terms of how much people can afford? You know, what does it actually mean to live on 1,000 yuan a month in China? Because it's obviously a country where goods are cheaper as well. So are we talking about people who are able to fulfill their basic dietary needs or housing or clothing needs? Are we talking about people who can't even meet that line? Are we talking about, you know, houses with indoor toilets and good sanitation, that kind of stuff? Could you paint a picture of just what it means to live like that?
First of all, almost everybody in China has their own house. There's no homelessness. Now, 89% of rural people have built their own house in their village. So if they're found on the street, you know, sleeping at night, the police grab them, put them on a bus and send them back to their village, and they have a home back in their village. That's kind of what happens. And 80% of urban people have their own home, and then the rest rent. So everybody has their own home. Food is quite cheap, and at 1,000 yuan a month, you can afford food and clothing. And so, yeah, you can get by in life on 1,000 yuan a month. The problem is, like I said, it's how you have an economy with 900 million people low income. You can't drive that economy forward. And that's why common prosperity, we need to think of how to make these rural people, their incomes rise. And that's a big issue. So China's big policy now, and again, these are changes. They see population is falling, birth rates are falling. Schools have fewer and fewer people in them, including local rural schools in county seats and prefectural capitals. And that also, you know, they built all this property around these fourth and fifth tier cities. So what they've started to do is they say, yeah, we got this hukou system, but we're going to let farmers and rural people move into our third and fourth, fifth tier cities if they buy a house or if they rent a house. And then they can go to the county schools and they can use, there'll be easy access to the county hospital, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's a great policy. Okay. And it should be beneficial towards human capital development, which we've been working on. What I worry about is if you let these rural people move into these fourth and fifth tier cities, you don't let them move into Shanghai, Beijing, Shenzhen, right? I mean, that they can't go there. There's 2,000 of these county seats, that fourth and fifth tier city. So I know you're in England, but if you're in America, our land size is almost exactly the same as China's land size. We have 2,000 counties. They have 2,000 counties. So if you think of a county in America, that's how big a county is in China, except there's five times more people per county. And what their plan is let's let these rural people move into the cities. All right, these fourth and fifth tier cities. And, you know, first of all, they're going to keep the property market from falling any further, and they're going to get good education. What I worry about, because the people who move in there, I'm getting back to your question, are these low income people. So 1,000 yuan or 2,000 yuan per capita, right? And so let's think about 10 years from now or 15 years from now, right? If there's 200,000 people in these 2,000 county seats, that's 400 million people. What does that economy do, right? There's no manufacturing out there. Mm. There's become some construction, but it's going to be over. And everybody's low income, and low income people don't consume services. So I think that this whole idea of trying to create, you know, 2,000 county seats with 200,000 people, I think you're creating 2,000 slums. Because the rich people will get up and move into to big cities, and low-income people don't consume services, and high-income economies are driven by consumption of services. So this big inequality of China is, I think that's what's holding them back now.
And this drive into these tier five cities that you're talking about, these county towns, I haven't heard much about it before, Scott. Can you talk a little bit more about that policy? Is it seen as a poverty alleviation method in recent years?
Well, it's been going on slowly over time, but it's, you know, they've been talking about getting rid of the rural and urban hukous. Okay. I don't know if you've seen that. There's some lots of discussion on that. But basically what they do is they take away your rural and urban, but they give you a county hukou. It's to try to help solve the property problem, right? So they've built all these apartment buildings and no one's there to buy them. So let the rural people come in and buy them or rent them. So there's also, when, you know, Donald Trump put on these big tariffs on China and trade was going to start, you know, falling, and, you know, all the other U.S., China, and the rest of the world frictions that were going on since 2016, 2017, China said, hey, we don't need the rural world economy. We're going to create a dual circulation economy. And dual circulation is that we're going to create our own demand domestically for our own products. We'll keep exporting and we'll keep some direct investment, but our whole economy is really going to run on our own selves, right? And that's when the policy of trying to encourage people to move into these county seats and prefectural capitals started. And now, you know, at the same time, right? Number of kids in schools are falling. They have all these classrooms and teachers in urban schools that aren't being used. So there's room to fill them up, which is, like I said, this is a good thing.
Mm. But I guess one shortfall or one limitation of this method as well is that these rural dwellers are taken away from their farm fields. You know, the farm fields that you've already mentioned in this episode that are like their baseline insurance policy.
Yeah. I don't think that's a problem whatsoever. I mean, 35-year-old rural individuals and below, 85, 90% of them have never farmed one day in their life. They don't want to farm, right? They don't know how to farm. And the farms are so tiny. I mean, they're 1 acre farms, right? I looked up one time, I think the UK, the average size farm is what, 100 hectares or something like that. I mean, in the US, it's now, you know, 3,000 hectares in the Midwest, right? I mean, it's just, it's incredible, right? But in China, it's a half a hectare. And agriculture is mostly mechanized now. It's not mechanized by the households. It's mechanized by custom services that come through villages. And it's plowing day. And, you know, five or six people who have a plow come through and say, we're plowing tomorrow. Who wants their field plow? And old grandpa and middle-aged mom who are managing the farm, all they do is come out and say, you know, meet me over on the field by the bridge at 11 a.m., and they go out and plow and they hand them 60 yuan. So if you want to go from a half hectare to 10 hectares, you can get rid of 20 more families and take them to the city, right? I mean, in Japan today, 3% of the people farm Japan, right? Today, China, it's 30% of the people are done. So we can get rid of 90% of the people out there in villages and the farming would still be equally efficient. So there's not a food security problem. It's, you know, it's important to keep agricultural productivity high. And China is very much focused on that. With, they think food security is very, very important. They've always thought Japan lost World War II because they were starved to death. I mean, it's part of their policy that they want to keep mostly self-sufficient in food. But that has nothing to do with taking farms to go from a half hectare to 10 hectares. So, you know, they can certainly do that.
Right. And then what do these low-income individuals do once they're in the counties? What jobs do they go for instead?
That's the problem, right? And like I said, there's some good things about this. So what used to happen is Johnny Wong goes out to a factory and meets Sally Chun, and she's from Heilongjiang, and he's from southern Shanxi, and they meet, and, you know, they date, and then they get married. They continue to work in the factory in southern Beijing. And then all of a sudden, you know, Sally's going to have a baby. What used to happen is they would come back to Johnny's village and they would build a house in there. And, you know, of course, there was no problem if Sally had been from the next village over or from, you know, the next town over because she spoke the local language. She's close to her mom, right, if there's any problems and everything. But, you know, Sally's now from Heilongjiang, you know, 1,000 miles away. And so, you know, Sally says, I'll marry you, Johnny, but we aren't going to build a house in your own village. And he says, hey, there's houses that we can buy or for rent in the county seat. And she goes, I'll do that. And so that's what ends up happening is that this is also a solution to that problem. The young people don't want to build a house in the rural area. And guess what? Buying an apartment, especially if there's a little bit of a discount in the county seat, is cheaper than building your own house way out in the countryside. So what happens is they come back and they have their baby. Johnny goes back to work while Sally's raising their baby and then grandma comes in. And then she takes care of the baby and Sally goes back to work. Grandma will either raise that baby in the county seat or they'll just leave their apartment empty and she'll take them back to the village until the kid gets 5 years old. And that's usually when Sally ends up quitting her job and she'll then raise her kid. She has a problem because there's not a lot of work to do in the county seat. And so these issues are just starting to come. So it's a balance, right? They've got better education and help for their kids, but their income. But what would Sally do if she was back in the village? She'd raise tomatoes, right? So she wouldn't do very much anyhow. And so she's probably happier in the county seat that, you know, she can go shopping easier and it's cleaner and warmer and that kind of stuff. So the problem becomes, you know, this family is now stuck on a single income because Sally's probably never going to get a job and Johnny can't come back because there's no jobs there. Right. So he's going to have to work outside, you know, of this county seat for a long, long time.
Is it possible to create more local jobs in these county seats? Sorry, that's, I know that probably sounds like a really stupid question.
But that's the problem that I talked about before, right, is that these are service sector jobs, right? And service sector jobs are created because people have income to purchase services. And Sally and Johnny aren't going to hire a maid to take care of their baby, right? They aren't going to order DoorDash to bring them, you know, their Starbucks coffee in the morning, right? They're going to get up and make a cup of tea themselves. It's people at middle income are the ones that are really consuming services. And that's the whole problem with, you know, dual circulation with the huge lower income class. These are the exact problems that Mexico fell into, that Brazil, that South Africa, that Turkey, these middle income countries that have been middle income. They have huge inequality, right? And so they move from poor to middle income. They do great because they have lots of labor and people are very disciplined. And they, but when you try to move from middle income to high income, your manufacturing and construction jobs all become computer science, math-based jobs. And the service sector is generated because you have very, very high demand for services. And that's the problem of trying to move up. You know, so I don't know if you've ever seen my book, Invisible China, but the entire thing is there's never been one country move from middle income to high income when they've had less than 50% of their labor force have gone to high school. There's been only three countries that are between 50 and 60%. And those three countries, Greece, Spain, and Portugal. And the reason they could move from middle income to high income is they joined something called the EU. Right? You know, you guys left them a little while ago. Remember that thing over there? But the EU then subsidized Spain, Portugal, and Greece for 40 years to finally bring their education levels up to like 70 or 80% of the kids going to high school. Because in a high income economy, if you haven't been to high school, you're a burden to society, not a benefit. Yeah, you need 20% of the labor force to be landscapers and nannies, right? But you don't need 70% of the labor force doing that.
So, Scott, if you talk to anyone walking on the street in China, Chinese cities, or, you know, anyone who has a passing knowledge of China, to tell them that education is one of China's biggest problems now, they probably wouldn't necessarily even believe you that proportion of people who've been to high school is so small. So does that tell us basically that actually that the troubles of rural China are actually really hidden? I mean, your book is called Invisible China. Is that what you meant by it?
So I say, is Scott the only person that knows about this problem? And the answer is absolutely no. I mean, if you look at the data, China realized around 2005 or 2010 that their education wasn't high enough. So they started expanding high school. And, you know, they added 10 million high school slots between 2005, 2015. Which is good. I mean, that's what they want to do. There are some quality problems because they expanded so fast, but, you know, they're continuing to work on that. The problem is, are kids ready to go to high school when they get to high school, right? Because the reason we're sending them to high school is we want them to learn math, science, computers, and language, because that's what you need to have a white-collar job. And about, you know, half of rural kids, when they get to junior high or high school level, they can't learn math, science, computers, and language skills. And, you know, the whole world struggled with this, you know, for years and years and years. And the economists are a little slow. We probably only 15, 20 years ago discovered a new field called babynomics, that it's 0 to 3 is where your cognitive skills, cognitive abilities are developed. And what we found is, you know, even today, the parents want their kids to go to college when the baby's 6 months old. When the baby gets to be junior high, they drop out or, you know, barely get through junior high and then they go to work, or they send them to a vocational school and they aren't learning math, science, and computers there, right? And this is a real problem. And you can see it. I don't care what you do. You go to any rural school and you give a 15-year-old, a 10-year-old, or a preschool kid, or a 3-year-old baby, you give them a cognition test. I don't like to say it because in China, you're not supposed to say it. An IQ test. You test their IQ. And guess what? Half of rural babies have an IQ less than 90. They're basically developmentally delayed. They perfectly fine to work in a factory and learn things. They can learn arithmetic in elementary school. They can learn how to read or write. They can learn discipline, but they can't learn math, science, computers. And it's a very simple thing. Is for 5,000 years, rural people were raising farmers, right? And when you raised a farmer, what did you do? You had three objectives. Don't die, be healthy, be strong, right? That's what you wanted. And they made a good farmer. That's what made a good farmer. Today, they want their kid to go to college. And then you say, well, do you read to your kid, your one-year-old? Do you tell them stories? And they'll go, excuse me, Scott, I didn't hear you. I think you asked me, do I read to my kid? And they say, of course I don't. My baby's a baby. You know, why would I tell a story to my baby? They're going to learn how to read in school, right, when they're five. And this is a very big thing around the world now. Brazil has a Ministry of Human Capital, which basically a third of the families in Brazil get directed training from the government programs on parental training of how to basically psychostimulate your baby, how to raise your baby so they're more cognitively healthy. And it's true in Peru. It's happening in Mexico. It's happening, you know, China hasn't done it yet. But we're doing these trials, right? We're doing experiments. And you'll go out and you'll teach the mom how to read to their baby, how to play, you know, interactive games with their baby when they're 1 year old. And then you ask them. So they've been doing this for 1 month. These are 6 or 1 year long programs every week. You give them two toys and a book, right? And then teach them how to do it. The next week you come with two new toys. You take the two old toys back. And so after the first month you go, are you reading to your baby? And they go, yeah, I'm a little bit embarrassed. And my mother-in-law scolds me for wasting my time. You know, it's, okay. Now she's been in the program 6 months. Do you read to your baby? Yes. How much? 4 hours every day. And my baby is the smartest baby in the whole village. And it's fantastic, right? And guess what? We did our first study in 2014, okay? The babies were 2 years old. And in 500 babies, we gave their parents parental training. You don't teach the baby, you teach the parents, right? And in 500 babies, we didn't teach the parents. After 6 months, the level of cognition of the treatment group was much higher than the control group. And the parents now believed in the importance of stimulation of their baby. They were talking to their baby and reading to their baby. Okay, we followed up in 2018, they were five. The treatment group, the ones that got the training, no more training after 3 years old. The treatment group was sending their babies to private preschools. They were buying more books, spending more time. Mom came back and spent time because they say, hey, my baby's really smart. We then followed up with them last year. They're 10. Math scores higher. Their cognition is higher. Their language ability is higher. The only thing different was these guys got training for when their baby was 2 years old for 6 months and these didn't. And it makes all the difference in the world, right? And that's the invisible problem right now. Now, the Chinese government is just launching a new pilot initiative on ECD, early childhood development for rural babies. That's the good news. The bad news is it's Yibai, Zhoushi, Yiga, Xin, 191 counties in 30 provinces. You know, the bad news is they don't know exactly what they want to do, and there's no money for it. And so they're going to richer counties that are willing to do it. But there's an expert group out there that's trying to figure out what to do. The ministry seems to be committed to doing this. So let's say that they roll out this big program next year. And from 2025 on, there's no more development delays. It's 2050 when we start to see an impact of this program, right? Because that's when they're finally going to be out into the workforce, right? And so China has some big, big issues that they have to solve. I say they need to basically slow down growth, put money into education, early childhood development, create rural unemployment funds, right? Right now, rural people can never be unemployed because they always have a farm to go back to. But these young kids, they aren't going to go back and farm. if they lose their job or their income is too low, what are they going to do? You know, are they going to start causing social problems? So, you know, I think that China needs to just say, we're going to have just a nice, stable, steady growth, you know, for the, and really they need common prosperity policies more than ever.
Mm. And Scott, you know, you seem to be suggesting that more education in a sort of intellectual way, more white collar jobs is going to be what pulls China out of this middle income trap. But how does that square with the current unemployment that we're looking at, where a lot of young people, not often from privileged backgrounds, do have pretty impressive educational backgrounds, but they aren't able to find the white collar jobs that they want and are actually being told you're overqualified, you need to go work in a factory?
Well, you got to get your economy growing too. So getting the human capital of your labor force up is absolutely necessary for long run growth. It's not sufficient, okay? Right? It's necessary, but not sufficient. So you really do need, I mean, you need to get your economy growing. And that's another whole set of issues. I'm a development economist. What do I know about macro economy, right? I often say, here's the list of the 39 high-income countries in the world. There's 39 of them. How many of them have planned economies? The answer, zero, right? There's never, ever, ever been a planned economy that's become high-income. I'm pretty encouraged. I see these new policy efforts to say, oh, we need to start encouraging private sector again. We need to start building confidence. That's what they need to keep doing. Reform and open markets. And we've seen it for 40 years on reform and open markets. That's what drove China forward. And we want a growing China. We want it for the world economy, right? We want it for Asian economy, and we want it for our Chinese colleagues. If we have a stagnant or falling Chinese economy, there's lots and lots of issues out there.
What about common prosperity in the way that it's been talked about so far then? Are you encouraged by what you've seen so far on that? Because to its critics, common prosperity, when Xi Jinping talks about it, seems more to do with fining big tech companies, rather arbitrary large fines or donations towards common prosperity funds. And that doesn't seem very open or market-based to me, at least. You know, have they got the right strategy when it comes to that?
Yeah, I think that common prosperity needs to start investing in the rural economy. And like I said, I think that it hasn't been rolled out yet sufficiently. I think it has a lot to do with human capital in rural areas, but I think it has to do with creating, like I said, these rural unemployment schemes, right? There's going to be unemployment among rural kids. They are not going to go back to the farm. Their families don't have money to let them lie flat. So their options are get through the times and, you know, hopefully find a new job. And you know, that's what happens now. Share jobs with friends and families. Or, you know, lots of people do when things get so bad they can't go forward, right? Then social problems start to arise. And, you know, that's why we need common prosperity. So we need, when they're unemployed, we need to support them. We need to have adult training. Adult training is going to be really, really hard. It's going to be very hard to retrain these 30-year-olds when they have a family, you know, and they don't have very high education levels and they have cognition problems. How do you train them in a high-tech, computer-savvy job? It's going to be really difficult. So that's what I'm saying is all of these things are needed, and it's at a time when fiscal revenues are down. And it's not going to be solved by high-tech philanthropy, right? Philanthropy is going to provide 1% of the money for a common prosperity. Governments are going to do the other 99%. So there's obviously lots and lots of challenges out there. When China recognizes a problem that they've, in the past, they've attacked it and they found ways to beat it. So I'm hoping that, you know, now that we see this economic slowdown is more than COVID, you know, ex-COVID problem, it seems to me that a lot of the things, not everything that they're doing, but a lot of things they're doing, you know, at least are moving in the right direction.
Scott Rozelle, thank you so much for joining Chinese Whispers.
Cindy, thank you. It's been enjoyable. Pushing me out to areas I don't, I think about, but, sometimes I have to rely on the expertise of others. So, but it's been fun talking to you.
That was my conversation with Scott Rozelle. Now, when Scott was talking about early years development, it really reminded me of a phrase that we use in China called 文化. It roughly translates to mean culture. And you might use it in a context to say that someone has a lot of it or doesn't have much of it. For example, oh, that person from the countryside doesn't have much 文化, to suggest that they don't have much culture. And I always thought that that phrase was a bit intellectually elitist, suggesting that just because they weren't educated to the same degree, that they lacked some kind of intelligence. But listening to Scott talking there, I realised 文化 maybe means more an understanding, a prioritisation, a valuing of an intellectual way of life, of a valuing education in a way that urban middle-class parents in China these days do. They do read to their children, but in a way that actually poorer parents don't know how to do that. And actually by pointing that out, that disparity in how you raise your children from the very beginning, it can also help us understand China's inequality as well. And I see in it a metaphor for China's growth as a whole. China has grown so much, so fast. Its material needs look like they're met. But actually, when you look at some societal problems that it has, you do wonder whether or not that's coming from the fact that its physical needs, its material needs have been met, but actually that its intellectual, spiritual needs of the people, of the society, are still lagging behind. Maybe because it's grown so quickly, there are still these growing pains there. I think Scott's comments provide food for thought on all of those fronts. Thanks for listening to this episode of Chinese Whispers. And if you like this podcast, do give us a rating and a review. And why not tell a friend about it too?